Good evening. My name's Scott Lee. I'm alcoholic. And thank you, Chip. It's good to see you again. He hosted us some time ago in Destin. We can't get away from some of these people. And that's good. That's good. I don't need to be getting away from us. I love us. I'd like to thank Lee, wherever he went. I guess he's here. Hey, yeah. Hi. And anyone else who made this possible, everyone, I know these things don't just happen, and we appreciate it very much. And John, thank you so much for coming up to record. I know, you know, you can get a lot of these AA speakers on the internet now for free, but that self-supporting through our own is important, because if we all do that, one of these days, folks like John won't be able to come here and record these. You might search your heart about that a little bit. It's important to me to say so. And I like to open anything I do with a quotation from Lois Wilson, who was asked one time what she did in a moment of silence. She said, "I invite God to the meeting." And it's not that I don't believe God's here. I do believe He's here. But I seem to get a special gift when I stop and honor that presence. And so in a couple of minutes, I'm going to ask you to do that. If you're new and you don't have a God, I'd like to recommend you borrow mine. I recommend him very highly. He has a great sense of humor. If you don't think so, look around the room. And I think we're pretty funny, don't you? And you're keeping me sober continuously since the 28th of June of 1984. I'm sober since a couple of days before my very first AA meeting. And I am going to talk about that and what a gift it is. One of my great teachers, a fellow named Don from Denver, if you've never gotten one of his talks, see John. But he didn't say God was a gentleman. He said he learned to treat God like a gentleman. Gentlemen don't go where they're not invited, and they don't stay where they're not made welcome. So I'm going to suggest that we all invite him, and then I will conduct myself, suggest that you do, in a manner that I think will make him welcome. The other thing I do in the moment of silence is I ask God to help me not judge the speaker. Now, you don't have to do that. And it'll be harder for me than it will for you. But I started doing that, and meetings got better everywhere. I don't know where all the idiots went. But anyway, if you would, let's take a couple of moments and literally acknowledge the presence of deity. And I'll just meet you back here. Amen. Thank you. I was asked to tell my story tonight. I'm being good, John. Don't pull me yet. Is that all right? Okay, good. Good to see you. I found the directions in the big book, strangely enough. Now, this is, if you don't recognize, this is the AARP version of the big book. This is so I can leave the reading glasses in the room. And it says on page 29, each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. That's not how I got here. I got here a victim of the delusion that I could wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if only I managed well. You recognize that? I'm so insane that I have times that I think if I can get what I want, it'll make me happy. Isn't that crazy? If I will look at the tens of thousands of times what I wanted, wasn't rendered happy. Anyway, I didn't start drinking until I was 18 years old. I don't know how many men I've sponsored who got sober before they were 18 years old. I just don't think they had the willpower to hang in there as long as I did. And I try not to feel superior to them. I was 18. I was in college. I was going through fraternity rush. The fraternity boys walked into a bar and ordered a beer. You know what I did? Right. I walked into the same bar and ordered, strangely enough, the same brand of beer they ordered. We start drinking beer. I don't like the taste. I don't like the way the foam feels going down my throat. It makes me feel full. I don't like that either, but I'm doing what they do. Because I'm the great chameleon. I can do what you're doing so fast, it looks like we did it at the same time. Just trying to fit in. And strangely enough, I finished my beer at the same time they finished theirs. And I think, let's get out of here. And they order another beer. Does anyone have a guess what I did? Ordered another beer. Sure, of course. What else would I do? And by the time the second one got hit bottom, I got the magic that all alcoholics understand. And the earthlings don't understand this because it doesn't do that for them. They just waste every drop they drink. And it's a shame. And I didn't drive in. By the way, Miss Linda, I live in Tennessee, but we've been in Orlando for the winter. And we drove up today, and I didn't drive 300 miles to talk to you. I came to talk with you. Play with me. It'll be more fun. Trust me. Let's see if we don't have all the same story. So when alcohol did its magic for me the first time, I got taller. Who got taller when they drank? Come on, taller. Put them up. Taller. How about better looking? Put them back up. Right? Yeah. Pimples fell right off. Uh-huh. Let's try this one. Expert on many subjects. Yes, Lord, we have experts. Yes, experts. Get ready for this one. Fantastic dancer. Listen to the dancers. Oh, let's do it again. Dancers. Yes, Lord, we have dancers. Yes. And gentlemen, now I can talk to the girls, right? What would you pay for that? And ladies, you could stand to listen to it. It's the magic juice that works for everybody. Wow. And I'd have paid a high price for any one of those. Hadn't got to the big one yet. The big one was for the first time in my life, something deep in my soul went. And it was just okay to be Scott. I was 18 years old the first time it was okay to be Scott. And I don't know how it happened. By the time I was 5, 6, 7 years old, I discovered what was going to be the greatest truth in my life until I've been with you for several years. And that great truth was, and it resided in the core of my being. It made all my choices. And it was that I'm not good enough. I'm one of the defective ones. There's things wrong with me that can't even be worked on, much less fixed. I became an actor as a small boy. And my act is, I'm going to pretend to be the guy that I think you want me to be. And use whoever's in front of me right now. Because I'm a different guy to everybody. At the end of my drinking, I got a customer in Morristown, Tennessee. He's a very religious man. He knows a very religious Scott. I got a customer in Knoxville, Tennessee. He's a Friday night party kind of guy. He knows a Friday night party kind of Scott. Right? I got the boys in the pool room where I buy my dope and drink my beer. They know that Scott. Neighbors, business partners, family members, everybody knows a different Scott. And the greatest fear in my life is that people from different segments of my life be at the same place, same time. How am I going to act? Because I'm acting. Everybody still with me? Yeah. And because I'm acting all the time. Just trying to hold up the right mask to keep you from seeing the real me. Because if a bunch of together people like you could see through this mask and see the real me, you clearly wouldn't want a guy like me around. And 2 beers later, I'm tall enough, smart enough to look up. I talk to the girls, expert on many subjects, fantastic dancer. And I transition in 2 beers from the fear that these guys will see the real me and not want me in their fraternity to, these turkeys are awfully fortunate a cool guy like me is here. Now, if you didn't happen to recognize that, that's an entire psychic change. And I think that's why Silkworth said that's what I have to get on alcoholism, is because that's exactly what it gave me. I think it kept me alive till I could get to you. I zipped through a 4-year college and 5 years and 2 summer schools. Come on, where are you? Yeah, these are my people. And I joined the United States Air Force and was sent to Moody Air Force Base. Anybody know where that is? Just right down the street to Air Force pilot training. In the second 6 months of that, we flew the T-38, which you're all familiar with. Tom Cruise thought it was a MiG in Top Gun. I got some news for you, Tom, I'm sure. And that's a Mach 1.5 airplane. It's a high-performance plane, which means faster than the speed of sound after burning jet engines. That's brake release to 40,000 feet in 3.5 minutes. Roll rate of 720 degrees a second. Yeah, that's twice every second. A loop is a 360-degree turn through the vertical plane, pulling positive Gs. And this airplane, we enter a loop at 10,000 feet at 500 knots. That's 550 miles an hour. Pull up at 5 Gs. I'll tell you what that means. You're pulling 1 G right now. It's a force of gravity. At 1 G, a 200-pound man weighs 200 pounds. At 5 Gs, a 200-pound man weighs 1,000 pounds. That is precisely what that means. Everything on you weighs times 5 and includes your upper eyelids. You'll notice that. All right. 10,000 feet, 500 knots, 5 Gs, wings level inverted at 20,000 feet. Takes 2 miles vertically to pull her over on her back. We lose 10,000 feet down to backside. Total elapsed time, under 25 seconds. I tell you all that for 2 reasons. The first one, of course, is to impress you. Anybody? Yeah, I'm up on that. You bet. You bet. And the second one is, I think it'll help you see my alcoholism and maybe yours. So we're finished about 5:30, head to the officers' club. I don't plan to get drunk tonight. I used to go out to get drunk a lot. My mission tonight is to get drunk. And if you're not going out to get drunk, I don't want you along. You're going to be a problem later. You drank with them, didn't you? Yeah, but only once. You don't do that with them again. And they should do something else. And but this particular night, I don't plan to get drunk because you know who the Thunderbirds are, the Air Force's demonstration team? I did not fly with them, but they flew this airplane for 7 years. And tomorrow morning, a buddy of mine and I are going to take off on the runway at the same time. And as the wheels are coming up, I'm going to slide up under his tail. And my head is going to be about 5 or 6 feet away from his afterburner. If I can stand up in my cockpit, I can almost touch it. These airplanes are white. And when we land, the top foot on the tail of my plane would be black from his exhaust. And we're going to be pulling 5 to 7.5 G's going over the top. Try to imagine you've just been notified that tomorrow morning, you're going to be strapped into the world's largest roller coaster that's going to run for 1.5 hours. And all you can do is ride. You would not plan to take a hangover on that ride. Are you with me? Am I going too fast here? Or is this good? Okay. So let's see if we don't have all. See if you can't tell the story with me, okay? So I want to drop by the club and socialize with the other pilots of my squadron. I'm going to have one no more than. That's exactly right. Now, I noticed some of you Al-Anons didn't play. I want to encourage you. This is what you heard on the phone. And you believed it again. That's why you have to go to Al-Anon. The ones that ran screaming from guys like me don't have to come to your thing. And so one no more than. I should be home by 6:30, no later than. It's good to have a plan. But what happens is by the time I get to the bottom of the second, I'm going to say beer. Could be Jack, and it could be whatever's behind the bar. It changed. By the time I got to the bottom of the second one, I think I changed my mind. It's not what happened. What happened was I got this craving Silkwood talks about. But I didn't know that. And I think I changed my mind. Jeez, George, I haven't seen you so long. Come on, and two more over here, bartender. You know, bartender, I think I'm going to watch one more quarter of the ball game, set them up again. Rack them up, Bob. We shoot a couple of more games. Two more over here. Think I changed my mind. Don't get home by 6:30 or 7 with one or two in me. I leave the officer club at exactly 1 o'clock in the morning because they... A lot of pilots here, Chip. We'll talk flying later. And I drive home drunk with a hand over one eye. Where are you? Hand over one eye, drivers. Okay, great. And I get to do this a lot with our good folks. And within the last few years, I have had two of our geniuses share these little characters. One of them carried a roll of duct tape under his seat. He was afraid a cop would see him with his hand up, so he put duct tape. I wonder what a cop would have. And I'm not making this up. And another one carried a pair of drunk driving glasses in his glove compartment. He sprayed one lens black. He just put them on. This is your gene pool, all right? These are your people. And so I drive home drunk. I walk in. My first wife rips into me. There's a lot of information in that sentence. And headed to the bathroom for my after drinking chores. Who puked? At least once. Come on, put them up. Who pukers? Pukers. All right. How about out your nose? Who puked out your nose? Oh, yes. For those of you who did not puke out your nose, we would like you to know that if you do, your sinuses will sting with every breath for the next couple of days. Is that right? That's right. Okay, who quit forever? Nose pukers, put them back up. Now, if you puked out your nose, you quit forever. I know it didn't stick, but you did, right? Okay, who quit forever in front of somebody? Who swore to somebody, never again? Come on, never again. All right, now, this I should get a lot. I was in Detroit last weekend, didn't get too many hands on this one, but down here I should get a lot. Who quit forever in front of somebody, one hand on the Bible? Come on. Yeah, we got a few of those down here. Okay. All right. Well, that's good. Who peed in the closet? Did you really? I never did that, and I'm so embarrassed for you. I don't believe I'd have told that myself. Big difference between sharing a meeting and a fist step. I don't believe I'd have told that. You might want to talk to your sponsor about the things that you cover. Who takes meetings into correctional facilities? Come on, put them up. Everybody else, if you're not rocking it into the fourth dimension, get with one of these people. Okay? I was in one of the Nashville jail 20 years ago, telling my story, and I tell it pretty much the same way. And I got to that thing, and I ad-libbed that who peed in the closet. And one guy put up his hand, and I did that to him. And you've probably been told they don't laugh much in the jail. Well, they did that night. And when the laughter died down, the guy said, "Hey, man, no big deal. It wasn't my closet." Was it your closet? You know, sorry, I shouldn't have asked those. And we have my tribe of guys in Nashville on New Year's Day. We take a meeting into the jail. They've got a recovery pod, 80 beds, and we're in there New Year's mornings at 9 o'clock. We call it our unusual places panel. It's unusual places where we have urinated, vomited, or come out of blackouts. And we do that on New Year's morning in the jail. And I'm telling you what, it matters. We've had some of those guys show up at our home group since then. I think laughter is a sound effect of recovery. And I think it is so critically important. So let me reset the scene. Okay, you see, I thought the two most important inventions of the 20th century, both invented by alcoholics, by the way. One was that little half moon of carpet they put around a commode for you to kneel on. That was invented by one of our people. You know, that hard floor on the knees is bad news. And that soft commode seat you could rest your head on in between heaves. You remember that? Those are really nice. They're not as cold as the porcelain, but they're really soft. Remember that? Those were nice. And so I'm in there bringing up my toenails, quitting forever. And I would pray the pre-AA prayer. All right, we're going to do it together. All right. I've been collecting pre-A prayers, and we're not showing hands on these. I've collected four so far. I'm going to give you the first three. They are, "God help me pass this test I didn't study for. Please don't let her be pregnant. I'm told I can be prayed in the first person. Please don't let those flashing blue lights be for me," is another popular pre-AA prayer. Let me reset the scene now. All right, it's 2:30-ish in the morning. I'm in there kneeling on the prayer rug. And I'm down to just noise is coming out. And I pray the pre-AA prayer. I'm going to do the first line. You do the second. Trust yourself. You know the prayer. Here it comes. "God, get me out of this and..." Which is alcoholic for amen. As you know. Is that right? Okay. And... Hey, listen, if you're new here and you're not sure you need to be here, we have a one-question test. Did you know the prayer? Stick around. So I brush my teeth and go to bed. And it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 2:30 or 3 o'clock in the morning. I get up at 6. I'm not even hungover yet. Remember that Wonderland Between drunk and hungover? Remember that one? Oh, yeah. And I am in that airplane. Oh, yeah. I'm wearing flight boots. I'm wearing a flight suit. I'm wearing a G-suit. I'll need it. I'll black out today without the G-suit. Yeah. Helmet, visor, mask. I'm sitting on an ejection seat. There's a 20-millimeter cannon shell under my seat. This is not a toy airplane. And we light afterburners, and here we go. And I am dying, man. I've got the hangover. My headache was always right here. It felt like a butcher knife went in right here. My eyelids are made out of sandpaper. My throat and nasal passages are raw. Right, from puking all that acid. I've got a tremor in my hands. I've selected 100% on the oxygen lever. It will not cure a hangover. I've tried it hundreds of times. I happen to have had the privilege of knowing Sandy Beach pretty well. He flew for the Marine Corps. He'll tell you that didn't. Talk to any of our pilots. It won't cure a hangover. We tried it over and over again. And I am tight on the leader flying this mission. And what I just described to you is willpower. And it is no defense against my disease. I was only 22 years old, and my body's resilient. By 5:30 that afternoon, I'm back to maybe 85%. I've been eating Alka-Seltzer and drinking whole milk and eating saltines. And I'll tell you one thing I know for sure, I ain't getting drunk tonight. No way in the world am I getting drunk tonight. Because tomorrow morning, I'm going to be number 4 in a 4-ship formation. Right? Today, there was 2 of us. I'm here. Tomorrow, there's going to be 2 more guys. There's going to be 4 of us doing this. Nobody with a brain would get drunk the night before going to fly number 4. Do I have to go on, or can you tell the rest of this? That's what I thought. Yeah, over and over again. And I finished, I had the gift. Some guys hit a golf ball 300 yards. I could just drive an airplane. I finished at the top of my class. My next assignment was a four-engine jet. I've been drunk on five continents and don't have any idea however many islands we stayed on. Flew all over the world. I went to Southeast Asia. I flew the original side-firing gunship, Spooky, or Puff the Magic Dragon, if you didn't know her. And they phased that airplane out, and I flew an intelligence mission over Laos. And that may still be classified. I know the rest of it is. And I'm not proud about what I'm going to tell you, but I was so drunk at 4 o'clock one morning taxiing my airplane out, I taxied off into the grass off the end of the taxiway. And it was my fault. My co-pilot was running the checklist, and I'm supposed to be driving. And I was drunk by our standards. Not this .08 social drinker, DUI, whatever it is around here, drunk. This is like 2.5 kind of thing. And I'm not proud of that. That's what alcoholism does to nice people like us. Is it has us disrespect the things we care the most out and tear the hearts out of the people that love us the most. That's what it does. And I'm just uncaught. If I'd been caught in that airplane that night, I'd still be in a military prison. I'm trying to press you. Simply tell you that taking meetings into correctional facilities has been an important part of my recovery program for over 30 years. I had about a year, and my sponsor said to me, he said, you're finished in public information forever. You are a promoter, and we don't do that. You will now take a meeting into the jail. I said, Jerry, I've never even been arrested. He said, I have a news flash for you, Sparky. The boys at jail are ready to know how to get arrested. They're not going to need your help with that. Rarely have we seen a person in jail who has thoroughly followed our path. And I've been doing it since. It means the world to me. It's been 20 years ago. I was sitting in a little restaurant minding my own. A guy walks up to my table and he says, you don't remember me, do you? I look at this guy. I said, man, I don't. If I should, I apologize, but I don't know you. He said, well, you came into a prison I was in a couple of years ago and you spoke and I heard you and I believed you and I'm doing what you said. And I'm never going to be incarcerated again for the rest of my life. And I'd like to thank you for my freedom. You do not want to miss a chance to have that happen. And I've had it more than once. I have never gone into a correctional facility to talk to an inmate or a prisoner. I go in there to talk to AA members that aren't going home tonight. That's who I go to talk to. At my last duty station, I was an instructor pilot on a four-engine jet with a worldwide mission. I taught people to fly a four-engine jet anywhere in the world in any weather. I was 26 years old, and I just walked away. Most people don't get to live their dream. I get to throw mine away. I resigned my commission. I'm honorably discharged. And I got a job as a sales rep in the summer of 1984. The president of my company came to me one day and he said, you're going to treatment right now or you're fired. The man was a great communicator. He could like explain stuff. And it was a gift. And June 28th, 1984, I signed into a little charm school outside of Atlanta to overcorrect for a problem I didn't have. And the staff didn't do it. I caught it from you. It was listen to you tell the truth about your drinking that let me see the truth about mine. My denial system, my insanity has no defense against your truth. And that's why I do so much on the drunkalogue, because I think it's really important, because that's how you got me. I didn't sleep the first three nights I was in treatment. Let me just say I could afford my addictions. And I'm laying there the fourth night knowing I ain't going to sleep again. And it stays dark a long time, at night. And it used to summon the day, but now it's just only at night. And I'm laying there, and it's like lights out at 11. I got to leave at 6:30, and whatever the numbers are. Short bathroom breaks, that's it. I'm stuck. I'm laying there in that bed, and I ain't going to sleep again. And I didn't do what I'm about to tell you, but I began to see my life as you might see a series of short movies. And just the important events. And I've always given myself credit for my intentions. I'm probably the best intended person you're ever going to meet. I do close-up magic. And I always intended to get a clown suit. And one of these days when I was on the road, instead of running the bars and chasing the dollies, put on the clown suit, take the magic kid into a children's hospital. I haven't done that yet, by the way. I'm taking full credit, right? Take that into the children's hospital, do a show for the kids. You got to take a fabulous guy to do that, you know, in one of these days. And I'm taking credit for my intentions, and the world is judging me by my actions. And this night, as I'm seeing my life, I can't see the intentions. And it's not a pretty story. And I got to the place where I began to think about the worst thing I've ever done. I got one stands alone. I've always been able to stop it. Not this night. Can't get it stopped. I can't get anything between me and what I've done. I do not know how long I lay in that bed with that going on. But I reached what I was going to call bottom for the next 30 years. I've got a new definition of bottom about 3 years ago from a guy I sponsor. But I got to the point where I couldn't stand to be me anymore, and I would have paid any price and done anything to get out from under that guilt. And from in here, I assume from my spirit, screamed. My head did not think this. My mouth did not say it. My vocal cords did not move. This part of me screamed to a God I don't think I believed in. God, forgive me. It was a lot louder that in, but it was inside. And everything I'm going to tell you happened in the next moment. There was suddenly this magnificent light shining just on me and on my bed. And the light had a warmth and a texture, and I could feel it in every cell of my body. And I was aware of every cell of my body at the same time. At the same moment, something very heavy that I was unaware of, that was laying all over my body, flew off of me. And it felt like I was going to float up off of that bed, and it did not scare me. And with my eyes closed, I could see that room in better detail. I can see this one now. There was behind me a partition. It was white. It came within about a foot of the ceiling. And this light was coming over the top, but it was all focused just on me. And there were some shapes. They were colors, as I recall, a yellow and a green, maybe about the size of my hand, but they were random shaped here and there around the wall. And it was coming through there also, but shining just on me. And I used to say God forgave me then, but I don't speak for God, and I don't like being around people that do. I know I received the forgiveness then. I don't know if he ever judged me. I can't answer that. But I knew that I received the forgiveness then. And that feeling all over my body felt so good it almost hurt. And I can't explain that to you either. But that's the truth. And I lay there in the presence of infinite love, having been forgiven for the worst thing I had ever done. And I don't know how long I lay there. I've had the privilege of telling this story to quite a few of our folks. And I've talked to a number of others who've had these. I've talked to a number of others who've had these who drank again, too, by the way. But they all agree when I say what we call time does not exist in that presence. And I can't explain that to you either. But I don't know how long I lay there with him. And I don't know of anything else that passed between us. I just have no knowledge. And I must have slept. And I say that because I awakened the next morning. I had not done that in several days. This is page 12 in Bill's story. But soon the sense of his presence had been blotted out by worldly clamors, mostly those within myself. I don't speak for Bill, but I'll tell you, for me, that event alone would not have carried me 33 years. It wouldn't have. It was just a cornerstone for a guy like me who was, I think, maybe on the verge of death and no one knew it. And I was a different guy the next morning, and the staff saw that. And I thought I had reached bottom. I thought, for me today, surrender and bottom and willingness all have the same definition. And the definition is my sponsor tells me to do something that I don't like, that I don't think will help, that I don't want to do, and I do it anyway. And anything short of that is a lie I'm telling me. So I redefined bottom because I wasn't there. And willingness and surrender I had to redefine later at the hands of a fabulous sponsor. With fangs. And thank God for that. And anyway, a couple of weeks later, I was called into my counselor's office. He was a member of Al-Anon. I salute you. The man saved my life. I got two things out of treatment. One of them was they fluff-dried my liver. And the other one was out of this event in this man's office. It's 11 o'clock in the morning on a weekday. And I'm called into his office, and he's working on my aftercare plan. I went in there with a really good attitude to assist him with that. Okay, if you're new and you're not laughing, listen real close, okay? And I came through the door and explained to him that I'm not taking antabuse. I'm not going to a halfway house, and I ain't staying past 28 days. to lay out their parameters, help the man do his job. I was just being helpful, you see. And he said, "You've left out something you aren't going to do." I said, "What?" He said, "You're not going to make it." Well, I took that personally, and I'm not a violent man by nature. I make exceptions. I made one for him. Fortunately enough, it was verbal. And I don't think it's possible to carry a spiritual message in a bucket of sewage. So I'm not going to be able to tell you exactly what I said to the man. I mean, the truth is, I didn't even know his family. But generally... But generally what I said was, "Why'd you say that?" And his response saved my life. He said, "If you already know how to run a program, keep yourself sober, how is it you happen to be a patient here?" I responded by very cleverly saying, and nothing came out. And I'd never had that experience before. I mean, I had to make some stuff up like you did, but I could always answer. Cannot answer the question. That didn't take as long to happen, just take me to tell it. That was a one-hour meeting. I know I stayed for the entire meeting. I heard nothing else as my mind locked onto the question that cannot be answered. And I left there and went to lunch. And from lunch, I went to the movie and group and physio, wherever I'm supposed to be. My body was there. My mind is in Jim's office trying to answer the question that can't be answered. And I'm walking across the campus at night at dusk around 9 o'clock. That would have been probably late July, early August. And I've always assumed the answer is flying through the air because it hit me in the chest. And this part knew the answer before this part knew. And the answer was and is, I don't know how to run a program to get myself sober. If I'm going to be one of the very few who make it, I'm going to have to do it all. This is not a cafeteria lunch for me where I can take what I want and leave the rest, because I must win this time. I must win now. And it was there that I began to embrace what my sponsor lovingly called Step 1, Section B. Aha. I'm not going to get to manage this thing. Well, I zipped through their 28-day treatment program in 6 weeks flat. And because I've always picked things up quickly. And I went back to Nashville, where the only person I knew in the city who was in recovery is one of my customers. I didn't want him to know. If you don't recognize that, that's newcomer thinking, terminal case. I'll die from what's going on here pretty soon if I get some help with it. I set out to follow the aftercare plan. They said 90 meetings in 90 days. I went to 87. I just can't remember two of them, but I know one night I'm about to leave for the meeting. My son fell and injured himself, put him in the car and went to the emergency room instead of going to the meeting. That's the right thing. And I can't figure out all by myself, you go to two meetings in a day. If you missed, I just missed. Minor case of terminal newcomer thinking, going to kill me fairly soon. I say, stay with me, old Playmates and Playgrounds. My favorite bar in Nashville is on 8th Avenue South. And I had a two-year chip in my pocket the next time my car was on that street. I would not turn onto the street for over 2 years. I'm not kidding. I was terrified of it. I completed this alleged fourth step. I'm going to give you one of our two best-kept secrets. The directions for doing a fourth step have been very cleverly concealed in the pages of this book. Yeah. And Don used to say, if you take the steps off the wall, you get off the wall program. If the steps on the wall were the whole program, we'd have a pamphlet instead of a book. Kind of an interesting point. But anyway, I took this true, false, multiple choice, do you still hate your mother questionnaire thing. And I called down to the treatment center to Bernie, who had not been my counselor, but he's a counselor down there. And when I had my white light experience, I read these steps. I see the confession in step 5 coming. I got to tell somebody who to tell. Bernie's the perfect choice because you look at him until he's stoned out of his mind. Really, I mean, his face is real relaxed. He's got this dumb grin. He kind of shuffles when he walks. You know what it looks like when they're stoned, right? I know. So I'm taking my fist up with this junkie. A couple of months later, will he know what I said? He won't even know if we did it. He's the perfect choice. I called. He said, yeah, I drive down. And I told Bernie the truth, which is where I began to get relief. If I'd been doing the actual steps, that'd be the ones out of this book. With an actual sponsor, that'd be one who's already done them out of this book, I would have gotten relief before then. As an aside, by the way, Bernie was not stoned. He was sober over 20 years. That was serenity. I didn't know what it looked like. It was just this minor case of terminal newcomer thinking that's going to kill me fairly soon. And I get back to Nashville, and the only thing I haven't done is get a sponsor. If you're sober less than a year, don't try to fill us in. You'll probably miss it. Everybody else, two-word fill in the blank. I'm so insane, I'm looking for a sponsor I can relate to. How crazy is that? Holy mackerel, I can't figure out you go to two meetings in a day. Who can I relate to? Whoa! I can relate to some other squirrel who has no hope at all. Thank God I didn't find a sponsor I could relate to. We'd both be dead. God deliver me from a sponsor I can relate to. No, please. What I need is a sponsor whose suggestions I will follow. Why would I do that? I want to look like he looks. I want to sound like he sounds. I want my life to work like it looks like his life is working. Anyway, I'm just crazy. And I finally spot this guy. And I realize we're graduates of the same university. I kind of relate. Okay, this might work. So I go up to Jerry and I say, would you sponsor me? And he says, do you already have a sponsor? I said, yes. He said, okay, here's your first assignment. Assignment? I thought sponsor like a new best friend, going to introduce you around, show you some of the better meetings, loan you some money, fix your wife, that kind of thing. Oh, I was wrong about a lot of things. First assignment. Yeah. Tell your other sponsor he ain't your sponsor anymore. Oh, God, what an order. I can't go through with it. Anyway, so I went and found the guy, and I thought, Jesus, I mean, you can't do this to somebody on the phone to tell this poor guy that he's not going to sponsor St. Scott of Nashville, and it's probably going to tear his heart out. I may have to hold him while he sobs, and it's going to be a terrible scene. And the guy had 15 years, and I said, I've asked somebody else to sponsor me, and he said, good, who? As I told him, he said, oh, I think he's to be a great sponsor for you. He's done the work out of this big book. He knows the book well. And he said, the sponsorship thing wasn't working for me either. I had no idea what that meant. Because I thought when I asked him to sponsor me, I was saying, I'm a dead weight. Would you drag me? You're going to hate this. Nothing in it for you. I was just wrong about that, too. And he says, let's be friends. Don't lose my phone number. I got to go make coffee. 15 years making coffee. There's a hint in that. And so I go to Jerry and I say, okay, I dropped him. Sponsor me. And he said, I'll sponsor you my way. I said, what does that mean exactly? And he said, you are too sick to stay sober on the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. You will need the program also. Now, I have no idea what he's talking about. And he gave me the single best kept secret in AA. It's the definition of the program. The way we keep it secret, we read it at almost every meeting. It's on page 59 in the text before step one where it says, here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. No steps, no program. Definition of insanity. Thinking you're in a 12-step program and not taking all 12 steps. Yeah, baby. That's it. That's it. And if you haven't taken all 12, how many have taken? That's how many step program you're in. Let us know how that works. Never mind. Just take the rest of them. We know how that works. That's why we took all three. Anyway, and he said, you will work the 12 steps the way I laid them out, the pace I set, or I will drop you like a bad habit because I don't work with losers. And he scared me so bad, the truth jumped out of me. I don't know about you, but I kind of saved the truth for emergencies, and I don't spread it around too thick. And it jumped out at him. I said, Jerry, I don't want to do the 12 steps. He said, that's okay. I said, good. He said, as long as you do them. I said, Jerry, I don't think we're communicating. He said, yeah, we've been hearing the word willingness. I said, yes. He said, well, here's the definition. It's when I tell you to do something you don't like and you don't think it'll work and you don't want to do it and you do it anyway. And that's what you're going to have to bring to this party. Well, I don't like how this is going, so I hit him with my best shot. I said, why? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That was a mistake. And Jerry says, I don't answer why questions from the men I sponsor. And the reason is why is a management question. And step one, section B says, you ain't in management. Consequently, all the questions begin with the word why have the same answer. The answer is, you don't need to know. Hated that when he said it. Today I embrace it. It's one of my cornerstones. See, I always thought it was not knowing that made me crazy. Incorrect. It was needing to know that was making me crazy. Yeah. And when I was able to give up my need to know, I began to know. Jim Williams, I don't know if John brought one of him, but Jim Williams, great AA speaker, talks about that so beautifully. But Boy, he had me dead to rights. And he said, I'll tell you what, I'm feeling generous. I'm going to give you one why question a lifetime. Don't ever ask another one. And I didn't for 25 years, at which time I went insane. I may not have time to talk about all of that, but I did go crazy doing that. And he said, the reason you have to do the 12 steps is because alcohol is not your problem. What? He said, it's your answer. It makes you tall enough, smart enough. You can talk to the girls, expert on many subjects, fantastic dancer. It's not your problem. It's your answer. And so that's why you can't lay it down and leave it down, is because when you do put it down, he said, you ever try to quit on your own? I said, yeah. He said, how many times? I said, I think about 2,000. I'm a nose puker. And we quit forever. Right, girls? Yeah. And when I put it down, it leaves me without an answer. I need an answer. I've never been an alcoholic. Wouldn't need an answer if I was an alcoholic. So to put that answer down and leave it down, you're going to have to pick up a new answer that's at least as good as the old answer. And I'm saying why every time the man takes a breath. And he says, our program's kind of like going to the dentist. We have to drill before we can fill. If we just fill with the good stuff, the poison's still in there. It'll detonate one of these days. So the drilling happens in the first 9 steps. But like the dentist, we got Novocaine. Here we call it sponsorship, fellowship, home group, love. It's not near as hard as the way you've been living. And this is where he got me. This next minute and a half is what I came to tell you. Because I'm still saying why every time he takes a breath. And he said, think of yourself as a garbage can. I said, okay, got that. He said, what we're going to do with these 12 steps is we're going to dump you out. We're going to scrub the can nice and clean and stand it back upright. We're going through your life and most of it's garbage and we're going to toss it. Portions are good. For example, you love your children? I said, yeah, a lot. He said, great. We'll keep that. We finish these 12 steps, you're going to be a big, empty, clean can with just a little good stuff in the bottom. And the reason is that one of these days something heavy is going to slam into your heart. He said, your father's going to die. And on that day, you got a little good stuff on the bottom. But on that day, if you don't have that big, empty, clean space to store that pain in, while we love you back to spiritual health, you'll escape. And the only escapes you know are killing you and tearing the hearts out of the people that love you. And I ran out of why. And I allowed the man to coach me through the 12 steps. And I got what I think is the most powerful promise in our book. It's the first line of page 60. It says 12. Having had a spiritual awakening is the result of these steps. Doesn't say a result. A is one of several or one of many. The is singular. Promise me one thing. Spiritual awakening. It is my experience. Spiritually awakened alcoholics do not drink beverage alcohol. And they don't take alcohol substitutes. And they don't get thirsty. If you're new, my mission as a sponsor is not to get my sponsee to the place where he never drinks again. My mission is to get him a spiritual awakening so he never gets thirsty again. Yeah. Yeah. If my sponsor calls, I came up and came in a shirt, a coat and tie, all right, but I'm burning up here. You ever meditate? Anybody meditate? Try to get your mind to a place where there's nothing? I just succeeded right here in front of you. I have no idea where we are in this. Yeah. Jerry was working me. And I want to tell you, he was only rough with me till I surrendered to him. And then he was just as gentle as he could be. I think his only mission was to be the midwife to my spiritual experience. And what a job he did. I'll be forever grateful to him. I don't think I thanked him enough. I know I didn't thank him enough. I'm going to tell you a horror story. This is a bad one. It has a happy ending. Hold on to that. In the wee hours of the 4th of July, 1993 or 4, and I've forgotten now, my daughter fired a pistol into her mouth. And I found her in a pool of blood the next morning. And I don't often tell this part of it, but I was in such a good place spiritually. And I knelt at her bed and I said, God, if it's your will to take her, take her. And if it's your will for her to be here a mess, okay. And if it's your will for her to be okay, okay. You had put me in, and I'm not holding me up as a shining example. I guarantee I'm not one. I'll prove that in a few minutes. But I was in a place where you had put me, where I could hold the most precious thing in my life up to a God who is worthy of that. I hope you're not called on to do that, but I was. We raced to Vanderbilt Hospital. For the first 4 days, the staff said to us, this is a successful suicide. She's just not gone yet. You'll bury her this week. We cannot save her. And 4 days is a long time. And believe if I had not had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, the man who came to you 33 years ago was capable of homicide. And I committed first-degree murder that week. Didn't have to happen. At some point over the next few days, best of my memory, I went home and packed a bag and I moved into a hospital room. And I stayed on the Vanderbilt Hospital campus for 60 days. So did you. You can pretend to care, but you can't pretend to show up. And you showed up. There wasn't a time in the next 60 days I want to remember my home group as close as I am to Chip right here. 24 hours a day for 2 full months you were there. Somebody must have printed a schedule. And it was not to keep me from drinking. I never even talked about that. So one of my people would be there to hold me if I needed to cry at 3 o'clock in the morning. One of my people to be there. I know who you are. I saw what you did. Don't tell me. I'm a word merchant myself. Show me. You showed me. You showed me. It was absolutely astonishing to me. I had been taught to cry by a member of my home group. He's a drummer of a band. If I said the name, you would know it. And I'm watching him cry in meetings. I'm sober about 2 years. And I went to him one day and I said, Tony, I can't cry. He said, I will teach you. And he did. Now, I can't cry on command, but I can let it go. And I wouldn't take anything for it. I think my emotions are how my spirit communicates to my mind and my body. And I can't afford to block that channel. And so I learned to cry. And if you'd like to learn to cry, if you'll see me after this meeting, I typed it up. And I'm not kidding. I'm not kidding. They're laying over here. And that's 2 pages. You need to get them both. And the back page is how I was taught to make amends to someone who's already dead. Don't doubt the power here. And I don't have enough to go around, but I'll run some more this weekend. I'm going to talk about 2 things I'd really rather not talk about, but I think it's really important that I do. If you've done what I'm about to talk about and you're okay with it, I'm okay with it. That's not why I'm here. I'm here to share my own experience. And as a young man, I paid for an abortion. And that used to fester my soul. I used to think about the what-ifs that came behind that. That's what I was thinking about when I was laying in that hospital bed and my soul screamed for forgiveness and got it. And I get to step 8. I know we're immense an unborn child. This is page 83. Some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter. Do not doubt the power here. I was shown how to write that letter. It's on the other sheet. It's on the back side of that how to cry thing. And it's been so important to me. Do you notice my demeanor doesn't change as I tell you that? Talk about a new freedom. That's what new looks like. That's what it feels like. I moved out of the home my first wife and I were living in when I was sober 6 years, just before my daughter shot herself. And what happened, and this is my story, I'm sure she would tell it differently, but if she was sitting in that chair, I'd tell it this way, because this is what happened from my perspective. She used to control me with my guilt, and I was guilty. And I went through these 12 steps and got my innocence back. She couldn't control me, made her crazy. And she was trying to control me one more. She was standing there screaming at me one more time. And she's like 5'5" and 100 pounds. And I'm 6'2" and 210. And I realize I am just before punching her in the face. And when she goes down, I'm going with her. She is on the way to the hospital. I'm on the way to the jail. It's a bad plan. I worked it all by myself. And it's a good thing what anybody else there. I did a bad face and she was still screaming. And walked out and got in the car and drove away. And started looking for apartments, and 48 hours later, I moved because it was imminent. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't believe in divorce, and yet I know if I stay with her, I'm going to hit her. And I was given a gift, and I'll share it with you. I don't ask you to believe this came from God. You need to know that I believe it did. The gift was 3 prayers. Prayer number 1, God, if it's your will for us to be together, put us together. Prayer number 2, if it's your will for us to be apart, put us apart. Those are the easy ones. Here's the tough one. God, if it's your will for me not to know today, leave me not knowing. Not in management anymore. The hardest assignment I've ever been given is 1 day at a time. To just be here. And I'm always off in the past. I'm always off in the future. Here, you want to hear tomorrow night's speaker. My friend Bob talks about this far better than I do. When he's not in the audience, I steal a lot of his stuff. But he's here tonight, so I might have to let that go. But don't forget to do that stuff. You know what I'm talking about. But you do not want to miss that. And I'll tell you what else you don't want to miss. My beloved here in the front row is your Elanon speaker tomorrow morning at 11, and I'll give you a guarantee. If you listen to her, she will give you some tools you will take home and begin to use today. I promise it. And you want Kent is also great. We were with him last weekend, and they said there were, I guess there's four speakers. Is that what we got? Four? Nobody knows. Are there any adults in the room? I'm sorry, I shouldn't have asked. Anyway, I had to put that plug in for these beautiful people. And then one day I knew. But that went on for a year. I was saying, my sponsor defined serenity. He said, serenity is not freedom from the storm. Serenity is peace in the midst of the storm. And the only way I can have that is to give up my need to manage the storm. And the only way I can do that is to know the manager of all storms. And isn't that what this is about? I think it is. And I was at peace for a year not knowing. One day at a time. I could pray that prayer and mean it. And not know and be okay. And then one day I knew. And when my divorce was final, Miss Linda and I began to date. And we married in 1993, I think, or 4, 1994. And, well, I got the right woman. I mean, come on. And I'm an easy grader on myself, aren't you? Yeah. And this AA microphone can be a very dangerous thing. And this speaking at conferences fell out of the sky on me when I was sober 10 years. And I did way too much of it. Some people can do a lot of it. I'm not one of those people. And in 2008, this is the other story I would rather not tell you, but I must. I started getting involved in internet pornography. And I couldn't tell anybody. I couldn't tell my sponsor. I couldn't tell my road dogs. I couldn't tell my closest friends. Because I was so enamored with the alter ego I call Saint Scott of the microphone. And which is a very dangerous thing. And I got sicker and sicker and sicker. And I don't think the first step in a bad direction is the big deal. It's the second one. It's because your secret, you're sick as your secrets. That's my experience. Because when I do it the first time, if I tell them myself, I don't have to go on. And a year later, a young lady suggested something and I violated my marriage vows. And I tell you, if you're doing something out of bounds right now, let me make a suggestion. Quit wondering what you're going to do if you get caught, because that ain't an if question. It's a when. And I was, of course, caught. And we tried to hold it together. Linda tried valiantly to hold it together. We got therapy. And eventually she divorced me, and rightly so. And the color went out of my life. And I lived in a black and white world for about 3 years. And I moved in with Wall Street Dan, a guy I sponsored. He took my guns, first thing he did. He said, you don't need to keep these. And I felt terribly unworthy. I dropped all the men I sponsored, and three of them refused to go. And I know that they were getting help from people. They weren't getting any help from me, but they refused to go. And those three men saved my life. And I sponsor them again today. And when Sandy died, and I had the privilege of knowing him pretty well, I went to his memorial service, and Linda was in the process of finding the gift of forgiveness, and she was going to be in Orlando, which is where his thing was, and said, let's meet, see what happens. And what happened was that the miracle of forgiveness, and as I tell my friends, we're the victims of a failed divorce. And one of my country music friends was working on a song with an idea I had, and it's I've Got My Favorite Wife Back. She said, I've been seeing you in that military haircut for too long. I want to see you in a ponytail. And I said, it's going to be a long war, son. Pick your battles. And so that's where the long hair came from. And what a gift it's been. Something happened to us when we first started dating, and we have heart connected. And through all of the hell I put us both through, that never left for either one of us. And what a gift, what an honor. A couple of more stories. I had an experience a number of years ago where I got to do something really good for somebody else and not get caught, which is my sponsor's definition of anonymity. is, I say, I give my last name in AA meetings in keeping with our tradition of anonymity. If that doesn't make any sense to you, I'd like to recommend you read the book, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. So a member of your home group goes into the hospital. You walk up to the reception desk and say, excuse me, can you tell me what room Chainsaw Mike is in? Get one of his talks, by the way. I did something really good, and I didn't get caught, and I never told a soul for about 6 months. But when you do something good for somebody and don't get caught, I get the gift, and the gift is a piece of sunshine about the size of a ping pong ball, and it lives in my chest. See, people know what I'm talking about. And as long as I don't tell, it stays there. And what happens is, if I don't get caught, is God gets the credit, and I get the gift. And it's a neat thing. And part of my morning prayers is I ask God to help me not miss any chances to be of service or to spread joy or love. And that's really kind of what I'm talking about. But there's another one, and I've already told myself on this one. But what had happened was I was fishing in the state park, and there's a family, and they've got a 7-year-old boy. Looks like he and I are going to fish together. I'm going to cast. He's going to do everything else. We caught a couple. I was between wives, and I had a chance. I had time. I got to know the family. Took the kid on a couple of trips. When I was 7 years old, I was a fisherman too. I was born with it. It's just what it is for me. And when he was 8 years old, and I was sure he really had it, we launched a canoe on the Buffalo River, which is about an hour west of Nashville. And it was one of those magic days. We caught over 100 fish that day, and he caught most of them. And the kid caught a 4-pound smallmouth bass, man. He got my fish is what happened, but I'm okay with it, really. I'm really all right with it. And about a mile before the takeout ramp, all of a sudden, and I mean all of a sudden, the sky is black and I hear the thunder. We're going to catch it. There's nothing we can do but hunker down and take it. I slid over to the side of the stream up under some trees, and I'm about to give God a little piece of, did you happen to notice Saints got down here? I'm not even kin to that kid. He caught the big... I'm about to do this prayer, you see. And the little boy looked over his shoulder and he said, is it okay to fish here? I tell you, walk this walk, you never know one of those is going to fall out of the sky on you. Isn't that the prayer I'm supposed to take to my Father when the skies of my life blacken and all I can do is hunker down and take it? Is it okay to fish here? That's my assignment. I asked Sandy not too long before he died what his mission was when he went to an AA microphone. And he said it was to comfort the disturbed and disturb the comfortable. My mission is I'm a step salesman. I'm here to try to convince somebody who's in the fellowship but not in the program to give the steps to try. That's what I'm here to do. And I hope I'm doing it. When I was new, I saw those slogans on the wall. And I blew off that one day at a time, which is clearly the most difficult assignment any of us has ever gotten, as far as I know. And it's hard to stay here. I discovered I have three vocabularies, a speaking vocabulary, a thinking vocabulary, and a praying vocabulary. I need to have the word today active in all three of those so I can just simply be here. So I want to fix the rest of my life, but I'm no good at it. And I think all the good questions contain the word today, and all the good answers contain the word today. And I can't afford the price of allowing anything to rattle around inside my head that doesn't contain the word today, because it just makes me crazy. And the only sanity available for guys like me is in the moment. The further mentally I get out of the moment, the crazier I get. I don't know how it is for you. That's how it is for me. But they had all those slogans on the wall. One of them said, turn it over. Well, I found out what it is. What I turn over is the result. How do I do that? One is I stay in the day where God is. And the second is I operate within His principles. I have to get out of the motive business. Page 60 in the text tells me I can't trust my motives. Let me give you from Chainsaw Mike, guy I mentioned earlier. Here's a misread on step 12. This is what it does not say. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these meetings, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and have good motives in all our affairs. No! Principle always trumps motive. My experience is that motive governs result irrespective of action. Principle governs action irrespective of result. So I turn it over to God as I stand today where He is and operate within His principles and get out of the motive business. Because I believe my own BS. I can hide a bad motive under a good one and fool myself with it. Yeah, I'm that good at it. There was only one slogan up there I was doing. You know which one it was, right? think. And it was explained to me what that means is, it says think. That means three thinks is the limit. Whatever it is, I can think about it once, that's good. Twice is good, I can think about it the third time. When I've thought about it the third time, I must lay it down. For if I were going to outthink it in three, I would about thunk it in three thinks. If I go to the fourth think, I've gone, I got a problem with step one, section B, I'm trying to manage it. Whatever it is, from international politics to the way you drive your car, to the fact that this fabulous Al-Anon speaker for tomorrow morning puts a toilet paper on the roll backwards, it should feed over the top, as I'm sure you know. Let's hear it for over the top. Thank you very much. See? And she puts it on that way. She says, since we have a cat, I've watched that cat for years, he does not use it. I'm going to take you flying again. I'm going to take you flying two more times. I was flying a four-engine jet, and we came out of American Samoa. We came out of Christchurch, New Zealand, about 8 hours. Take on fuel at Samoa, going to Honolulu. Look at your globe. There's nothing between but water. And halfway across, we get into the new fuel. It's contaminated. There's water in it. At our altitude, it's minus 50 degrees, and it turns to ice and clogs the fuel lines. And jet engines about this big around do not respond well to that. And we come down, because we ain't had one stuck up there yet. They will come down. And we get down into the warmer air. We run the engines down here. We can't make Honolulu at this altitude. We already can't go back. A jet engine is more efficient at higher altitude. And so you plan your fuel load. We go back up. We can't stay. Worst thing you do for gas mileage is this in a plane. That's what we're doing. Because the numbers say we're going to put a 300,000-pound airplane into the Pacific Ocean today at about 150 miles an hour. And that was not the flight plan. And we're all going to die. I bet there's a lot of people in this room who have thought they were going to die in the next moment or two. We've laid down bikes and wrecked cars and trucks and looked down gun barrels and drug deals gone bad and faced jealous spouses. Yeah, a lot of us have had that feeling for a moment or two. Let me tell you what, 4 hours is a long time. And I promised to God, I don't think I believed that He would get me out of this one. Oh, quit smoking. That was first. I'm going to quit smoking. I'm going to quit drinking. I'm going to quit visiting ladies I'm not married to. I'm going back to church. I might build some churches. We don't leave anything in the bag on this one. And they got everything out of our way. When I came up on Honolulu approach control frequency, there was nobody else on it but me and the tower. And we turned final. What we decided, as the fuel tanks are all reading zero, if we could make high station for a forced landing, we could at least crash on dry land so our bodies could be sent home for burial. That is the conversation in the cockpit. 4 hours is a long time. And we put it down on the numbers and taxied in and shut it down. They dipped our fuel tanks like you dip your crankcase. So much oil they got. We had insufficient fuel on that airplane to crank four engines and taxi to the street. We did not have that much left. I went straight. I did not check into the quarters. Went straight to the officer's club, put my bags down on either side of the bar stool. I said, Mai Tai, the tall one, pack of Marlboros. Right? Right? And when I look at it through the eyes you have given me, this is what I see. In those days when I prayed, I was trying to make Him my God. What I've been taught here is how to make me His man. Yeah. Yeah. My last flight on a high-performance plane, which was here, was at Valdosta. I leveled at 40,000 feet 3.5 minutes after takeoff. And Jacksonville Center gave me all of controlled airspace, which is 18,000 feet to 60, and what they call a barrel is a 30-mile circle around a point on the ground. If you're going to play at 700 miles an hour, they have to give you some room. And they told us regularly not to go above 45,000 feet in this airplane because there are things that can happen in the very thin air at ultra-high altitude that you will not recover from. Let me translate not recover for you. That spin, crash, burn, die, and owe them an airplane. That's what that means. But I was young and immortal, and I wondered how high it would go. I came back out afterburner because it gets really quiet at high altitude if you run the afterburners when the engines quit. So I've got all the power this plane can take, and I pulled the nose up, and I rolled into about 15 degrees of bank, and it just keep me in this 30-mile circle. And I'm climbing. I'm doing 9 tenths of the speed of sound, which is right at 700 miles an hour. And the answer to the question is 52,300. At 52.3, she was done. And I rolled out. I happened to roll out on north. and I looked for the first time. I was where the state of Florida goes like this. I was right in here, and I was looking north, which is this. It's not anyway. And I looked for the first time. I'd done an instrument climb. The sun's coming up over my right shoulder. The sky above me is as black as this tablecloth at 9:30 in the morning on a clear day. I looked out to the west and I saw the curvature of the earth. And I didn't see it a little bit. This thing we're riding is blue. It's beautiful. It's a ball. It's round. And it's held there by love, I think, because I didn't see anything else. And I had a sensation like something warm had been poured over me and ran down me, like wax down a candle. In the poem High Flight, the author says, I put out my hand and touched the face of God. I did that day. In 1967, there were not many people who'd seen the curvature of the earth. I broke a bunch of rules and I saw it. And today, all the fighters that go to those kinds of altitudes and the people who fly them refer to seeing the curvature of the earth as touching the face. That's what they call it today. In 1967, it didn't have a nickname. And I brought it down, shot one approach and landed. And I didn't tell them. I may be the town drunk. I ain't the village idiot. I don't tell them. They have to catch me. And I didn't tell the story. The time I was in the Air Force and I spoke at Burke Harlan's 12-year birthday. Get one of Burke's talks. Most spiritual man I've ever known. And I told that story. And in the telling, I said, I don't know why I'm telling this. Of course, you do. It was my first spiritual experience. I just don't see it for 30 years. I am not a skyrocket to recovery. And you can't do something like that and not want to do it again. In 2004, I owned my own business. I had a pretty good year. And went out to National International Airport and I chartered a Learjet. They don't let me drive anymore. But I put Miss Linda and two kids in the back of that thing. A Lear will go to 51,000 feet. Would you like to know how I know that? And I'm planning to see the curvature of the earth again, aren't you? We serve a big God. I've been learning to dream big. I stand up here in my stocking feet. We invited God. And my feet could be on holy ground. And I take my shoes off every time. Try to carry that in my heart. It's been pretty decent with it tonight. And if you borrowed my God, by the way, when we started and you got touched, borrow them again. If you invited yours and you got touched, do that some more. But let's honor those moments of silence. They're there for a reason. You've heard me talk a lot about a fellow named Don from Denver, who was one of my great teachers. And Ms. Linda and I had the privilege of spending his last Thanksgiving with him, and everyone in the room knew that's what it was. He was the man I could call with a question nobody could answer. And he answers it right now. And you know it's principle based. It's going to work first time, every time. How in the world is he doing that over and over and over again? And I was finally able to ask him a question that had been scaring me for a long time. I said, Don, what are guys like Scott going to do when guys like Don are all gone? And this beautiful, humble giant of an AA member cupped his hands like this. And he looked at me and he said, I have been bringing you hands full of water. Go to the river. And that was the answer. That was the answer. Metaphorically, he said, he gained access to a power and a wisdom vastly beyond his own that he believed was available to me, and I believe is available to everybody in this room. I want to close with what I think is the most important thing I've said tonight. I think it's the most important thing ever been said in an AA meeting. I think it's the directions for getting to the river that Don talked about. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. I love you with all my heart. Thanks.